Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we spend the hour with the one, the only, Martin Yan. For 40 years, the host of Yan Can Cook has brought Chinese and Asian cuisines into the homes of Americans. We talk with him about his life and journey. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow, it'll be a mostly sunny day around the bay, high temperatures upper 50s to the upper 70s, and then things starting to warm up a bit. It looks like 73 should be the high tomorrow in Walnut Creek, San Carlos 66, 75 in Livermore, and 64 tomorrow in San Francisco and in Sacramento. An excessive heat watch will start Monday morning and run through Wednesday evening. This is KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, 11 p.m.
Hello, welcome to Weekend from the BBC. I'm Luke Jones. Ahead on the programme, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi will be sworn in today for a third term in office, but this time at the head of coalition. We will hear from the deputy leader of the resurgent opposition Congress Party. Also, will Mexico's first female president ever advance gender equality? One of the country's leading novelists tells us the jury's out.
In a way, she has always claimed herself a feminist, Claudia Sheinbaum, but she also has other policies that contradict that idea.
And with me throughout the programme, Rosa Friedman, Professor of Law, Conflict and Global Development at the University of Reading, and Andreas Oshagen, who is a senior researcher on the Arctic at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute in the Norwegian capital, Oslo. That and more is ahead on Weekend after the latest BBC News.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. Voting is taking place in 21 European Union member states on the fourth and final day of elections for the European Parliament. The elections are forecast to see a surge in right and far-right representatives. The vote is not supposed to be about national politics, but as our Europe editor Katja Adler explains, the reality is rather different.
Although this is a vote for a European institution, across the EU, many don't have policies in Brussels on their mind when they vote. Instead, they use this election as a referendum on, sometimes a protest against, their own government back home. Right-wing and far-right parties have made significant gains across Europe in recent years, including amongst first-time voters. Polls suggest this rightward shift, often driven by concerns about migration and the cost to taxpayers of environmental policies, will be reflected in the new European Parliament.
The European Union's top diplomat has strongly condemned the killing of Palestinians in the Israeli military operation to rescue four hostages held by Hamas from a refugee camp in central Gaza. Josep Borrell welcomed the freeing of the hostages, but described as appalling reports of what he called another massacre of civilians. The Hamas-run health ministry said more than 200 people were killed as Israeli forces fought Hamas in and around the Nuseirat refugee camp. Israel put the figure at less than 100. The father of one freed hostage, Noah Agamani, was delighted at his daughter's safe return.
Please don't forget that there are another 120 hostages in captivity. We must release them and make every effort in any way to bring them to Israel and their families. By the way, it's my birthday. Look what a gift I got.
South Korea says it'll resume propaganda broadcasts against North Korea for the first time in 6 years. Seoul's National Security Council said its decision to install loudspeakers and begin broadcasts on the same day was in response to Pyongyang's campaign of sending balloons carrying rubbish across the border. Our correspondent Shama Khalil is following developments in Tokyo.
For the last week or so, since the end of May, really, this has been a back and forth in terms of escalation of the rhetoric, if you will, but also these continuing rubbish balloons from the north. So it happened on the 29th for the first time. And since then, hundreds and hundreds of balloons have crossed into the south, containing everything from rubbish, scrap paper, plastic, and sometimes actually animal excrement, animal manure. And this has really angered the south to the point where the president in his Memorial Day speech on Thursday could described it as despicable.
BBC News. The surge in tourists visiting Japan has caused critical shortages in aircraft fuel across the country. Government sources say the demand for fuel from international flights has outpaced the capacity of refineries. More than 20 million people visited Japan last year, mainly the key cities of Tokyo, Kyoto and Osaka. Two cargo ships have caught fire off the coast of Yemen after they were attacked. There were no casualties in either incident, and both fires have been extinguished. The maritime security company Ambrey said an Antigua-flagged vessel was heading southwest along the Gulf of Aden when it was struck. The second ship was 80 nautical miles southeast of Aden when it was hit by an unknown projectile. Major restoration work has begun in Sweden to protect the wreck of a magnificent 17th century warship, the Vasa, which is housed in a museum in Stockholm. Details from Michael Duncan.
The four-year project will right the hulk and provide a steel structure to support its weight. The lavishly decorated oak-hulled galleon was built to be the flagship of the Swedish Navy, but lasted only minutes into its maiden voyage. It was top-heavy, and it tilted as soon as it encountered a mere breeze. The ship then capsized and sank after water flooded through the open gun ports on the lower decks. The Vasa was finally raised from the seabed in 1961 and found to be almost completely intact. Since it was put on display, it's been one of Sweden's most popular tourist attractions.
Sunday marks the 90th anniversary of the cartoon character Donald Duck, who made his first appearance in a short Disney animation, The Wise Little Hen, in 1934, dancing a hornpipe. The character, known for his perpetual bad luck and distinctive high-pitched and distorted speech, has featured in more than 150 films. BBC News.
Hello, welcome to Weekend on the BBC. I have with me in the studio throughout to help me analyse, discuss and question Rosa Friedman, Professor of Law, Conflict and Global Development at the University of Reading here in the UK, and Andreas Osthagen, who is a senior researcher on the Arctic at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute in Oslo. We'll hear more from both of those in a moment. First, let us continue to think about the fallout of the Indian elections. Narendra Modi is going to be sworn in as the Prime Minister for the third time in a few hours. He will do so, though, as a somewhat diminished figure. His ruling BJP lost its overall majority in the Indian Parliament. He will now rule thanks to the support of smaller regional parties. Yogita Lamaya is our South Asia correspondent. I asked her if there was a big sense of occasion today.
There will be a very grand ceremony this evening at the presidential home in Delhi. Lots of top leaders from neighbouring countries have also been invited. Narendra Modi will take oath of office as the Prime Minister for the third time. Along with him, a cabinet of ministers will also be sworn in. And right now, you know, in the domestic news space, there's a lot of speculation about who's going to be sworn in and how many of the smaller allies are actually going to get ministerial positions.
And these smaller allies, that there's 15 parties, correct me if I'm wrong, do we know what kind of sway they will have over Modi, how they'll be able to steer him, or is that maybe entirely down to what positions they get, as you suggest?
So because the BJP's won 240 seats, to win a majority in parliament, to form a government, you need 272 seats. They're short of 32 seats. Among the allies, the two key parties are the Telugu Desam Party, which is a party from southern India, a regional party, and the other one as well, the Janata Dal United from the state of Bihar, again, a regional party. And the reason I cite these two parties is because between them, they almost make up the 30 seats that the BJP needs. Now, just to add, most of these parties, this alliance that the BJP is part of, it's long been a part of this alliance. So this alliance is not new. What's new is that the BJP has not won a full majority on its own. That's why it's going to have to make concessions to its allies, not just on cabinet positions, but potentially even on parliamentary positions, such as the position of Speaker, for example.
What do you think this whole affair has done to Modi's standing in the country? That there was a point where he was almost a rock star politician, some people suggested. He was a real personality. Has that image been dented by all of this?
He still remains extremely popular, but I think what over the past 10 years, because of his absolute grip on power, there was an aura of invincibility around him that has been damaged. And we've been on the ground in the days after the results came out in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is the most populous one, the most politically significant one. And one of the things we've seen on the ground is people voted on issues. You know, the issue of religion, the big temple that Mr. Modi inaugurated that was expected to dominate the election. It has not panned out on the ground the way many had expected it to be.
That's Yogita Lamai, the BBC South Asia correspondent. If Narendra Modi's BJP party saw their authority dented in these elections, Congress, India's once dominant ruling party, experienced something of a comeback, doubling its number of seats. What are their plans for the new parliament? Gaurav Gogoi is the deputy leader of the Indian National Congress in the Indian Parliament. I asked him why the electorate still doesn't seem to trust them to govern.
I must give credit to the Indian electorate because they have voted with sagacity. The issues which dominated this voting, this elections, were the issues that have been consistently raised by the opposition mandate. There's issues pertaining to the principles of Indian democracy, the safeguarding of the Indian constitution and its values, the upholding of our parliamentary tradition, along with economic issues related to unemployment and inflation, as well as social justice for the weaker section of Indian society. These were the issues that dominated the voting patterns. So we are grateful to the Indian electorate, and we also do realize that it is a mission half done. Our mission is incomplete. We have to continue to strive to regain the principles of democracy and parliamentary traditions that we have talked about in our election campaign. Even if we had formed the government, we still had a long way to go, and we continue to have a long way to go. Even though we are in the opposition, we are grateful and will continue to work hard gain the trust.
And when you say you have a long way to go, in what regard? What is it that you are saying or doing that you think the Indian public don't yet quite agree with or trust? What do you have to change?
Again, as I said, we have to continue to persevere. You have to realize that
keep trying with the same thing.
We have more elections to focus on. We have to gain power in many states. There are three to four major states going to elections in a few months from now, and we have to showcase through our state governments or our provincial governments as to how we have gone about addressing those very same issues at a state level platform. I think we've come a long way. Just 2 years back, our party was at its nadir, and we were really struggling. I think it's been a comeback journey, and you should not look at this journey only from the perspective of this year. But 2 years prior, we were absolutely in a much more weaker position.
Okay.
After which our leader Rahul Gandhi undertook two nationwide yatras, one by foot. He crisscrossed the length of this country, over 4,000 kilometers by foot. And I think that has been the surge for the Congress party, and also led to a decrease in the vote share of the ruling party of Prime Minister Modi's party in many states across India. So as I said, it's a mission that we started 2 years ago, and it's a mission we'll continue working on.
On the new government, I wonder what you make of this alliance which Modi is now having to sit atop. Do you think he'll be forced to rule in a different way?
Well, once there is an alliance government, a coalition government, you do need a leadership which is much more inclusive and is open to listening to divergent views. And I doubt if Prime Minister Modi possesses those qualities. He has led an absolutist government, something which the people have rejected. He has won with clear majorities. His party has won with clear majorities in the last two elections. So I doubt, you know, if he has shaped the government to have those necessary people who can act as mediators between various regional parties, because their interests in the local states are very divergent on social issues, on economic issues, on political issues. So we are going to see Prime Minister Modi struggle to continue with his aura, but at the same time, you know, bending And being much more flexible to the demands of his two regional allies.
And just finally, very briefly, if you would, did you have any discussions with some of those regional parties which are aligned with the BJP? Did you discuss with them the possibility of switching to supporting Congress?
Well, you know, we are ourselves are part of an alliance government. We are, and therefore, any decision to be taken is to be taken collectively. And at this point, we have decided that we are going to wait and watch and see what how this new government pans out. We have to first ourselves, because the results just got declared on the 4th of this month, we ourselves have to sit together to chalk out our own agenda, our own roadmap, and any decision to be taken forward will be taken collectively.
That is Gaurav Gogoi, who is deputy leader of the Indian National Congress. Let's return to our panel, Rosa Friedman and Andreas Osthagen, who are in the studio with me. Hear a bit about your work and things you're interested in. Andreas, you've got an interesting slice of property you can tell us about on Svalbard.
Yeah, well, it's not my property. It's 0.1% of the Svalbard archipelago, which is actually 16% of Norway. Which is quite a bit of land.
Yeah.
Svalbard is really, I mean, if you haven't been to Svalbard, and I guess many people haven't, probably maybe shouldn't go because of climate change and all CO2 emissions. But still, if you Google Svalbard or just search Svalbard, because it's a fascinating part of the world where a tiny population of 2,500 people live, barely any roads, barely any infrastructure. There's an airport you can get in and out, and there's polar bears roaming around. So if you leave the premises of the main settlement, Longyearbyen, you have to carry a gun. Yeah, so for safety purposes, because people do get killed by polar bears on Svalbard. And it's really what makes Norway Arctic. I mean, I'm from the Arctic, but it's not really Arctic. Svalbard is real Arctic. And the story that's been getting quite a bit of attention over the last few weeks has been that the final privately owned land on Svalbard is up for grabs. All of the rest of it, 99.9%, is owned by the Norwegian government or Norwegian state. And that's a conscious...
Even the bits that people live on, so as in what is leased to them.
Yes, and that's that's a conscious effort by the Norwegian government throughout decades to try to consolidate sovereignty also by holding land. I mean, and there's also, sorry, there's a tiny piece that is also owned by a Russian state-owned company because there's Russians also living on Svalbard. So it's a fascinating story with this final piece of land because the owners have been trying to sell it for quite some time now, and the Norwegian government hasn't been willing to pay. So then they went out publicly in international media and said, China is showing an interest. This is a geopolitical piece of land.
Yeah.
The Norwegian government or someone else should cough up the money, asking for 300 million euros for this tiny piece of land, which is, it's basically worthless because you can't actually, you're not allowed to, per regulation, to do any type of economic activity on it because it's environmentally protected area, pristine nature. At the same time, it is also located on this archipelago in the Arctic, which is becoming part of this geostrategic competition. I mean, earlier on this show, we talked about India's Arctic interest. We could talk about China's Arctic interest. Svalbard is close to Russia and Russia's nuclear capacities on the Kola Peninsula. So it's not completely irrelevant in a larger geopolitical competition, if you will. The Norwegian government doesn't want to buy it.
And as you said, it's being offered for 300 million euros and it's 60 square kilometres, 23 square miles. I'm told that's the size of Manhattan. And yet, to your point, there's not much you could do with that land except the value in that it's strategic.
Yeah, and right now you couldn't really start any form of activity up there. You're dependent on the Norwegian government allowing it. But I think the idea, at least from the seller's point of view, has been to highlight that, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 years down the line when the Arctic sea ice has melted even more, there's even more shipping, more economic activity in the Arctic, perhaps owning this piece of land might be a good investment.
Yeah. And Rosa, in your world, you've just finished co-editing a book, is that right, on international responses to what happened on October the 7th. Why did you start that project?
Well, really, we wanted to try and document what was going on around the world. The rise in anti-Semitism started on the 7th of October, so long before Israel entered into Gaza, long before Israel tried to root out Hamas. There is a humanitarian catastrophe there. But why did anti-Semitism rise the day that more than 1,500 Jews and Druze and Muslims and Christians, Israelis, non-Israelis, were slaughtered by a terrorist group. Why would that cause a rise in global anti-Semitism? So we wanted to look across different disciplines to try and understand what was going on in Mexico and in Poland, in Germany, in England, the rise of anti-Semitism, how the response, particularly on the left within politics, the anti-Semitic discourse, including in Norway. There was a huge rise in anti-Semitism in Norway itself, one of the few countries that didn't show solidarity by putting the Israeli flag up, even though many countries did put the Israeli flag up. And I know this because a colleague of mine, Torkel Brekker, has written extensively, including for our collection, on why it is that the left in Norway is so anti-Semitic, not just anti-Israel. We put together this collection when it was meant to be one book, and we had so many responses from so many people that we ended up doing three books, one on law and society, one on universities, and one on anti-Semitic discourse. And I think it's a really important, raw and urgent response. It really documents what was going on in the immediate aftermath of the worst pogrom against Jews since the Holocaust.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you once you'd gathered all of that?
I mean, it really surprised me that in countries with a history of slaughtering and persecuting Jews, which is most countries in the world, but in countries like Germany and in France, countries like the Netherlands, where Jews in living memory were rounded up and slaughtered and put to death simply for existing, that synagogues were being attacked, that Jews were scared to walk in the streets, that the response to what had happened, these atrocities in Israel, was to attack Jews. I think having that documented evidence showing the rise in anti-Semitism, even though I was aware of it, felt like a massive slap in the face. And I think that the contributors to this book have really showcased just what a problem it is. 14 million people of 8 billion people, Luke. It's 0.2% of the world's population. It's a tiny group. Why are they so hated?
Interestingly, you mentioned that one of the books, it actually focuses specifically on what happens in what has been happening in universities. Why has anti-Semitism seemed to flourish there, do you think?
I think we have to go back to the fall of the Soviet Union, and the far left, who are so against capitalism, are so against the West, looked to partner up with anyone that would take on the West after the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And they partnered up with radical Islamists, which is how we had the revolution in Iran. Right? It was actually Marxists together with radical Islamists. And then as soon as the revolution happened, the left got crushed by the Ayatollah and his supporters. That started out as a fringe movement in universities, but has become mainstreamed. And that mainstreaming has meant that within the university sector, there are certain things you're not allowed to talk about. And one of them is anti-Semitism. If you talk about anti-Semitism, people say, but there are legitimate criticisms of Israel, which of course there are. There should be legitimate criticisms of Israel as a democracy that occupies Palestinian territories. We should legitimately criticise any country that does human rights abuses, which is every country in the world. But there is a difference between being anti-Israel or anti the Israeli government and the kind of anti-Semitism we see at universities.
It's fascinating. Rosa, more from you and Andreas in a moment. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC. Each year in London's Hyde Park, an architect is invited to the Serpentine Gallery to build their first structure in England, a pavilion. This year's was inspired by an open courtyard found in traditional Korean homes. The 23rd Serpentine Pavilion is called Archipelagic Void. It was designed by the Seoul-based architect Min-Suk Cho and his firm Mass Studies. It is the first time a Korean architect has been commissioned for this prestigious project, and it just opened this last week. The BBC's Seren Ha visited the gallery in Kensington Gardens in Hyde Park and met with the architect.
I'm hearing this sound in the middle of Hyde Park in central London. It's traditional Korean vocal music with a hint of modern electric sounds. And it's coming out from speakers installed in a black wood frame open gallery. This open gallery is one of the five islands that makes up this year's summer pavilion at the Serpentine. So what's so special about this year's pavilion? Well, the clue is in the title, Archipelagic Void.
We started out looking at the area that has been used the most. And then we thought maybe this time we should start out emptying that space and find other opportunities. You don't have a project like this. Amazing, great artists and architects explore in same site every year different way. Where do you find that experience?
That's South Korean architect Min Seok Cho, who designed this year's pavilion. The central void actually resembles something called a madang, a small courtyard found in old Korean houses.
So Korean old houses, you know, you have, this is where you, in late October, you have become red because the chilies get dried on the madang to become chili pepper. Sometimes a wedding happens, funerals happen, you know, and it's like the collective activity.
So archipelagic void, like in Korean culture and also maybe in Asian culture in general, there's this idea about less is more. Mm-hmm. Like you can only fill in once you empty it. Mm. Is that kind of related to your work?
Yes, very much related. But for me, it's really about creating emptiness, but as a result of, I would call it gentle prescription, suggestion of what should happen. You put few things with the intention, and then the rest, unintended, it has this almost yin-yang kind of a way of presenting itself to people.
So what did the audience who had the first peek of the pavilion have to say? This is artist and poet Wilson.
This one in particular, I feel like, is one of the more open ones in that there's a lot of light being let in. I felt this one is very much inviting for all people and all environments, let's say. As we mentioned, the kind of star shape, I do need to come back and maybe try and get a drone to see what the top down view looks like, because it's a really stunning space.
I'm Tian, I'm an architecture student. It's definitely one of the most colorful pavilions I've seen. I've seen black before in pavilions, but not this sort of contrast with neon pink and orange, which I'm glad is reflected in the pamphlet as well. And like all, in my opinion, well done pavilions, there's just such good assimilation between the exterior and the interior, which I feel like has been done here.
The growing international interest in South Korean culture has given them more opportunities to be involved in global projects like these. But he says there's still much more to do.
I think they are genuinely curious, but I find myself also about to spend a lot of time explaining the cultural, economical, political context of Korea, because I think it's really about that. We call it a compressed history, right? From very poor state, also very authoritarian state, military regime, but then things evolve so quick and progress, but that's okay because it's also Koreans are so start to be known, you know. Like for example, American architect, they don't have to go through all the histories, and when I give a lecture, half the time somehow I end up explaining my work. I'm thankful, but I mean, one is more privileged to be a little bit known than the other side. I think the world is not completely flat. There's a little bit of slope happening.
His Seoul-based company, Mass Studies, has several major cultural projects on its way. It's in the process of converting an old power station by the Han River from the 1930s into a cultural complex, which Cho describes as a budget tape modern project. Another is a vertical stack of cinemas for the new Seoul Cinematheque in the historic Chungmuro Film Industry Center in Seoul. He says it will create space for archive films and encourage the next generation of filmmakers.
The BBC's Serin Ha reporting. Rosa, Andreas, have either of you ever been to the Hyde Park Pavilion? Rosa, you must have been at some point. No?
Not that I remember, sorry, Lou.
No.
Yeah, when I was a student, actually, yeah.
Did you?
A decade ago. So
good?
Yeah. I mean, parks are the place to escape London during the heat, no? I'm not the biggest fan of being in these big cities when it's warm and summery outside, but I get the parks, and London has a lot of parks, so that's a perk.
Yes, you do get to a point sometimes in a big city, if you're there when it's very hot in the height of summer, and you realise that all the clever people have left. they remember that this happens each year and have vanished. What about you, Rosa? Are you a sort of city person during the summer or not?
I mean, what I really like is to escape a little bit to the countryside. My father is a beekeeper. My mother...
Is he?
Has goats. They make their own cheeses. They're fantastic.
And goats, cheese and honey together. Perfection.
Absolutely phenomenal. That is, Luke, why I am the size that I am. but no, where they live is absolutely beautiful, flat countryside. You can hear the birds. You can smell the different things growing in the fields. And it's just heaven. But I couldn't live there. I just like to escape there.
Why couldn't you live there?
Too quiet after a while. We did live there for a little bit of time during COVID. Everyone else was locked down at home. We were locked down on... you know, massive fields, long walks and everything else. We were very spoilt.
Andreas, this was your childhood, though, sort of far away from everybody, enjoying the countryside.
Yeah, I saw two cities in the end, but Oslo is kind of a lowest common denominator. It has nature, it has access to the fjord, to the mountain, or hills at least,
yes.
But it's still a city-ish, so a combination.
We'll give it that. Rose, Andreas, thank you. More from them in a moment. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the US is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media, with support from Progressive Insurance, offering small business owners protection for what they've worked hard to build with over 30 customizable coverages. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com.
One of our partners managed to get 3 tons of salt and 6 tons of vegetable oil. But we need another ingredients to make food.
This weekend, one group's efforts to get aid into Gaza. Also, new jobs numbers, what's left for the Supreme Court to decide, and a milestone birthday for America's angriest duck. All that and more Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition starts at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning here on KQED.
Hello, welcome to Weekend on the BBC with me, Luke Jones. A female Mexican novelist will tell us about the cautious optimism for the country's first female president in a moment. We'll also discuss why the top policeman in London thinks 4 million men around the country are a threat to women and children and what he thinks should be done about it. Plus, the BBC podcast host asking why 3 million Indian people who died in the Bengal famine have been forgotten by history. We'll get to that and more after the BBC News.
BBC News with Neil Nunes. Voting is underway in 21 European Union member states on the final day of elections to the European Parliament. The elections are forecast to see a surge in right and far-right representatives. Correspondents say are increasing their support, particularly among voters concerned about immigration and the cost of green policies. The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, has strongly condemned the killing of Palestinians in the Israeli military operation to rescue 4 hostages held by Hamas from a refugee camp in central Gaza. The United States has denied allegations that its floating pier, intended to bring humanitarian aid into Gaza, was used to support the hostage rescue operation. 2 cargo ships have caught fire off the coast of Yemen after they were attacked. There were no casualties in either incident, and both fires have been extinguished. South Korea says it'll resume propaganda broadcasts against North Korea for the first time in 6 years. Seoul's National Security Council said its decision to install loudspeakers and begin broadcasts on the same day was in response to Pyongyang's campaign of sending balloons carrying rubbish across the border. The surge in tourists visiting Japan has caused critical shortages in aircraft fuel across the country. Government sources say the demand for fuel from international flights has outpaced the capacity of refineries. Major restoration work has begun in Sweden to protect the wreck of a magnificent 17th century warship, the Vasa, which is housed in a museum in Stockholm. The ambitious project will take 4 years and cost $19 million. And Sunday marks the 90th anniversary of Donald Duck, who made his first appearance in a short Disney animation, The Wise Little Hen, in 1934. BBC News.
Hello, welcome to Weekend on the BBC World Service with me, Luke Jones. I have in me in the studio, keeping me company, Rosa Friedman, who is Professor of Law, Conflict and Global Development at the University of Reading, and Andreas Osthagen, who is a Senior Researcher on the Arctic at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute. We'll hear more from both of them in a moment. First, a word about the fallout of those elections in Mexico. The historic elections. They elected their first female president in the 200-year history of the Republic. Claudia Sheinbaum was confirmed on Monday and will take office in October. It was quite the decisive victory. She won 60% of the vote. Addressing supporters, the former mayor of Mexico City promised to address the causes of violence and improve the lives of women.
As I have said, I didn't get here alone. We all came here with our female heroes that gave us our land, with our ancestors, our mothers, our daughters, and our granddaughters.
Will she achieve what she promises, though? Mexico has a reputation for machismo culture, a reputation hardened by a war between the state and the drug cartels for over two decades that has cost more than 60,000 lives. So can the election of Claudia Sheinbaum actually help improve the lives of women in Mexico? Ara Garcia Junco is a Mexican writer and novelist.
For me, it's a bittersweet victory because, yeah, in a way, she has always claimed herself a feminist, Claudia Sheinbaum, and she has done some things that may go that way, but she also has other policies that contradict that idea.
Shall we take those one by one? So first of all, what has she done in the past which you think has been especially feminist?
She has put a very big emphasis on gender violence, which is a very important thing in Mexico because we had around 11 femicides per day. So that's a huge number of women dying because of their partners most of the time. And she also had a policy regarding, it's called public school uniforms. Girls wouldn't have to wear a skirt if they didn't want. And that's, I think, a very good thing and a very good signal because it's ridiculous that you have to be wearing a skirt just because you're a woman. But also, let's go to the other side of the coin. Yes. In some feminist demonstrations for the last couple of years, there have been a lot of repression. There was even one a couple of years ago when they used gas. There was also a moment when she had a lot of talking with feminist activists in Mexico City, but that didn't really go anywhere.
And there could be a view that says that she has been working underneath her mentor, the outgoing president, AMLO, for a while, and that when she actually takes over, might she do things slightly differently because she is in charge?
Yeah, the question that everybody has in mind, because she was very close to AMLO's politics and she didn't really have that space to move because he was like over her shoulder all of the time. And I think we don't really know who Claudia Sheinbaum is. Right now, she has a lot of power. We'll see if there is not a big resistance, even inside of the same party. And maybe one of the big questions has to do with sustainability and decarbonization of the country, because AMLO was really into fossil fuels. He really wasn't trying to do anything different regarding the climate crisis. So, and she's a climate scientist. So that's one of the things that we have to see how she managed to accomplish.
You mentioned the safety of women is one thing that you'd like to see addressed. What else is there that you would like to see her address as part of a feminist agenda?
I would really like to see that there is more talk about trans rights, because one of the things that we as a very large group of feminists saw is that she had some transphobic people in her cabinet, but she doesn't have a clear discourse about that. So we don't really know, again, what she's going to do in that regard. And also, she seems to be very shy about using the word abortion. I don't know if it was because of the elections or whatever. In Mexico, abortion is legal, but it's a very recent accomplishment. So it's always a possibility that we can lose that.
It's interesting. We were saying a moment ago about it's a question over whether she'll change now she's actually in charge and when she gets the top job. But it sounds like she hasn't really even been clear about what she thinks in the past. I mean, that's just something that could continue, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think it can be. And I also think that AMLO isn't really retiring because he says that he's going to retire, but he has been in politics for all of his life, basically.
So you think he'll still exert an influence over her?
Oh, I very much think so. And I think that many of the people who vote for Claudia think that too, because he's such a big figure and such a loved one that I think his shadow is still really big. And I also think, because we have to look at the bright things also, that she's different in many ways and she hasn't had the chance to show that she's different. And there is one particular thing that she will do different, and it's regarding the speech surrounding violence against women, because AMLO said a lot of very regrettable things about, for example, how often women make false claims about violence. He had like this very machista thing about saying that most of the time they were lying. He said it a couple of times. And I don't think it's possible that Claudia will do that. And also, I think she's facing a very hard time because there will be a lot of misogynistic things in the media from now on. I have started to see them now.
In terms of the violence, though, I mean, it's such an enormous problem that Mexico particularly faces. Do you think that she has the strength and the ability to actually tackle that problem, which will affect so many women around the country, the power of these drug cartels?
Yeah, well, that's impossible, I think, by this point. And there was like a really notorious thing in these campaigns. No one really focused on violence. No candidate, because I think we have been in this violent environment for so many years that no one is really expecting for anyone to come with a solution, because I don't think it's possible in just a couple of years.
Do you think there'll be much of an impact just of her example and the fact that she is in that office? Will that filter down? Will the example that that sets change things?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, because that's a very big thing. I think that's the biggest thing of all. First of all, the possibility for her to be a candidate wouldn't be possible 10 years ago. I think that will open a lot of doors for young women, because it's really important to have an example of what you can achieve.
That is the novelist Aura Garcia Junco on the new president-elect of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum. Back to Rosa and Andres in the studio with me. Rosie, we sort of seem to expect a lot of female leaders, especially ones who are taking the office for the first time in a country, that you need to not only be an example, but do lots of gender equalising policy work as well.
Yep, and we expect this of, say, female peacekeepers as well. We expect them to be peacekeepers and then to police the men to make sure that they don't rape or exploit or abuse women while they're doing their roles. We always have this kind of double labour on women. First of all, to do the job and probably do it better than men, just to prove that they should have a seat at the table. And then secondly, to advance women's equality while doing the job. At the same time, it's really important that when you can see it, you can be it. And for girls to see women in leadership roles normalizes it to them and makes them think that they can be it. And just by being in that role, she's already making a difference.
And that is the first time that's happening in the entire history of the Republic in Mexico. But in Northern Europe, Andres, you know, we've seen a lot of female leaders.
Yeah, but I think to Rosa's point, there's a difference here between the actual policies, the practical effects of the policies that are implementing. And in that case, whether it's in Mexico or a Nordic country or in the UK, you might not necessarily have policies from a female prime minister or leader who actually moves gender equality forward. But as Rosa is highlighting, the symbolic effects, which also in the long run might also do something with systemic differences between genders also, because women leaders then tend to also look into hiring other women leaders, which again might break some of the male clubs that we see dominate also in Northern Europe. And so I am hopeful that having a Mexican female president might at least have the symbolic effect and maybe even actually lead to practical policies to do the same.
Thank you both. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC World Service. We've just been hearing about the challenges facing Mexico's president-elect, Claudia Sheinbaum, making the lives of girls and women better. But here in the UK, there are difficult challenges as well. On Tuesday, the most senior officer of London's Metropolitan Police Force, Mark Rowley, said that millions of men in England and Wales pose a danger to women and children. So Mark, who's the force's commissioner, told a body overseeing policing in London that the scale of offending by men against women and children was beyond the criminal justice system to tackle. His figure of up to 4 million male perpetrators of violence against women and children was based on a forthcoming study produced for police chiefs across the United Kingdom. Shabnam Chowdhury is an independent consultant on policing and a former detective superintendent in the Met Police who specialised in domestic violence and abuse, and is live with us. Morning, Shabnam.
Good morning, Luke.
So Mark, as he has it, he says it's eye-watering numbers. What sort of pressures does that put on a big force like the Met in terms of staffing and having officers who can be able to respond to that kind of problem?
Well, it's been significantly huge for a long time, but only last week on the 6th of June, So Mark also announced that the Met is heading for its lowest levels of staffing levels. This was at the Select Home Office Committee. They have a budget hole of £400 million. Their front line is depleted due to competing demands. Every week you'll see some form of protest, large protest, that have to be policed by local officers and centrally. So they're depleting the front line, the neighbourhood policing of officers to continue with business as usual. That's just a snapshot of some of the real challenges that are faced by policing. And I think you need to add to that their recruitment and their retention at the moment is actually rock bottom. Mm. They can't recruit officers, and officers are coming in and leaving within the first 1 to 2 to 5 years. And there's a serious lack of experience within policing.
And yet,
so that's just a snapshot of the demands that you place on policing.
Yeah, and yet Sir Mark was seemingly suggesting that actually this problem is so large, it's actually beyond criminal justice and the criminal justice system. It's beyond policing to be able to deal with this. So I guess no amount of police officers would be able to properly get on top of this.
Well, I think that's quite a bold statement to make, but I think that if you look at what's been going on in the last few years, in April 2022, the Met published their action plan to tackle violence against women and girls. In February 23, the Home Office included violence against women and girls on the strategic policing requirement. In the same year, the National Police Chiefs Council assessment placed violence on the same footing as counter-terrorism. And then this year, the counter-terrorism approach was adopted by Maggie Blythe, the National Police lead for violence against women and girls. Well, this was after the publication of the Angiolomini report that was published. What this appears to be to me is it demonstrates that there seems to be a lot of rhetoric, but they need some concrete action. And I think that Sir Mark definitely feels that he's not getting the support, the funding, the training, the resources to actually be able to deliver on this really serious issues that is a national problem for the UK.
Shabnam, I've got two guests with me in the studio who might want to chip in. Rosa.
Good morning. So we know that the problem is men. Men are the people that perpetrate violence in this way, and that's exactly what was named in this news story and in this forthcoming report. But we also know that there are problems within all institutions, including the police. Until the police have proper safeguarding in their own institution, they can't go out and prevent male violence outside of their institution. So all of these strategies are great, but what is the police doing about safeguarding, risk assessments and addressing male violence from within its own force?
Well, that's an excellent question. And you will know that what happened with Sarah Everard, who was brutally murdered at the hands of a police officer, David Carrick, who was a prolific sex offender and a rapist who was recently, in the last couple of years, convicted. These reports, the Met have said themselves, there's a huge amount of work. There have been a number of action plans in place and they're struggling to deliver them. Mm. I would say about the Met in particular, and this is not in their defence because they've got a huge mountain to climb, but in my service as a police officer, since retiring, I've never seen so many police officers that are being sacked, that have been rooted out, that are the rotten apples. Mm. And that is just a small turnaround of what is going on. So that adds to the issues that policing currently has. The problem they have is they need to create safe spaces. When female officers within policing in particular, because in the main it is female officers that are targeted, where there's misogyny, sexism, racism, violence against women and girls, domestic abuse, which previously have been brushed under the carpet, they need to have these safe spaces. And the problem that occurs is as soon as these allegations are made, the victims are then turned on and then they become isolated. They're subject to discipline, performance issues, management action, all sorts of issues within policing. And these are the areas within policing that need to be tackled on a national level, because this isn't unique just to the Metropolitan Police. This is prevalent across policing. And I absolutely agree with you. If you can't get your own house in order, then you are never going to be able to build the trust and confidence of women and girls outside of policing if they don't trust that they can come to you. And I want to be clear on one thing. The figures that Sir Mark Rowley mentions is the tip of the iceberg, because there are thousands and thousands of women and girls that don't trust police, that don't report, that go to third-party reporting sites, that still won't come to police to report these issues. So it's on a much bigger scale that they have these the violence against women and girls.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, this report was actually about male violence across society, not just in the police.
Yes.
I think that we need, as institutions, whether we're the BBC, whether we're police, whether we're a local library, to have risk assessments and child safeguarding and proper addressing of male violence against women. We could address a pandemic by locking everyone in their houses. And yet around the world, we're not just talking here about the UK, we're talking about India, where women can't get on trains without being raped or abused, and all other sorts of countries. We're talking about a pandemic, or it's actually endemic, of male violence against women. And we all need to find ways within all of our institutions to implement safeguarding against that. So it's not only about the police getting their own house in order, but also all of our thinking beyond criminal justice and beyond law, to think about what do we do to address that within our own lives, within our own organisations, within our own families. How do we challenge this male violence against women? Because women are literally losing their lives because of it on a daily basis, more than we can count.
Mm. Shabnam, just briefly on that.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think this needs a far better and bigger collaborative approach. Education starts at home. It also, there needs to be funding within the schools. I remember when I was serving officer, we did some training to some of the schools across East London about radicalisation to children. So we trained teachers to spot the signs, to create safe spaces for children, and they need to have the same approach within the education system. When they're giving funding to charities, etc., for youth, you know, clubs and so on, in that business case, they need to include training and talks to young people around misogyny, sexism, abuse and violence. And they need to be able to create safe spaces within schools, within those public spaces where young people go, in order to educate them so that they themselves are able to challenge safely, and also to be able to report abuse within their own families, because this does become a vicious circle, particularly for young people that are subjected to abuse within their own family environments.
We will have to leave it there, I'm afraid, but good to talk to you this morning. Thank you for your time. That's Shabnam Chowdhury, an independent consultant on policing and herself a former detective superintendent in the Met Police. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC World Service. Just a reminder of our main headline. Voters in more than 20 member states of the European Union are taking part in the final day of elections to the European Parliament, with the right and the far right expected to surge. During the Second World War, at least 3 million Indian people who were British subjects died in the Bengal famine. It was one of the largest losses of civilian life on the Allied side of the war, but there is no memorial to them anywhere in the world. Not a plaque, nothing. How can it be that 3 million lives disappear from public memory like that? It's a question which the BBC radio series and podcast 3 Million has been addressing in recent weeks. A new episode airs this week, and we're joined in the studio by Kavita Puri, who is the series creator and presenter. Welcome to
Thank
Weekend.
You.
Thank
Lovely
you for coming
here.
In. Why did you want to address this question?
Well, I mean, it's not a subject, the Bengal famine, that I learnt at school when I was learning about the war. And when I came across it by chance and I saw that at least 3 million people had died, I couldn't believe that we don't know about this, and I wanted to investigate how it is that the memory of 3 million people can just disappear.
And before we get to that, maybe for anyone who still doesn't know, just explain what the Bengal famine was.
So the Bengal famine happened in 1943, and the causes of it are hugely contested and very, very complex. The Japanese had swept very quickly across Southeast Asia by early 1942. They were on the border of Bengal, and hundreds of thousands of Allied soldiers were in Calcutta, and labourers came to kind of build, make things for war on the Asian front. And so there was huge pressure on food resources, and the colonial government began printing money, so inflation was rife. And then when the Japanese took Burma, the crucial supply of rice no longer got into India. And then colonial policies, like the denial policy, where they confiscated rice, and rice was the staple food. They confiscated boats where rice was carried, because they feared that if the Japanese invaded India, they would take those and sweep through India. And so rice began to be hoarded and prices rose. Mm. And so it's a kind of heady mixture of many, many factors. But millions of people in Bengal were already just about surviving. But I suppose the really controversial bit, and it probably explains why we don't remember, is the role of the wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill.
I see. So actually, as you've gone through this and tried to look at why it's not remembered or taught or memorialised anywhere, is part of it a racism to a certain extent, and part of it, as you say, not wanting to tarnish the memory of people like that?
So I think, the role of Winston Churchill is incredibly complicated. And you know, if you type the words Bengal famine into social media, it's like, people feel very, very strongly on both sides. And I suppose we'll never know. The question it was all about, could he have done more once he knew to send resources in the middle of a war to India? And it's all about shipping, because shipping was absolutely vital in the war. I suppose the heart of it was his racism towards Indians, which is well documented. Did that affect his decision making? And we don't know that. Yeah. And so that's the heart of the controversy, I suppose. And you know, we in Britain have a particular view, as every country does, of its war story. We saw it rightly this week, but the Bengal famine is a difficult bit of colonial history, but it also complicates our own war story. Yeah. And so you can see how it's difficult for us to remember it in Britain.
Before I bring in Rose and Andreas, I just want to give people a flavour of the latest episodes, Silk Scarves. It's about the continuing legacy of the famine in Britain. You met Susanna Herbert, the granddaughter of quite a senior colonial figure, Sir John Herbert, who was governor of Bengal in 1943 during the famine. She told you her grandfather shouldn't have been appointed to the job.
He had skills, he had honour, and he should not have been appointed to the post of running the lives of 60 million people in a faraway corner of the British Empire. He just should not have been appointed. You know, if you could reach out to the past, you'd say, don't do it. Don't go. Don't go to India.
Because?
You will not do a good job.
Incredible candour from her there, and you can sense her struggling with it.
And she didn't know about the Bengal famine. I mean, she didn't know much about her grandfather, who was the most senior colonial figure in Bengal at the time. And actually, it was only when she heard the series that she looked into it. And yeah, it's a really difficult legacy for her. But I think by on an individual level, she's trying to grapple with this very complex family legacy. I suppose we in Britain are doing the same.
Yeah.
And it's not just on subjects like the Bengal famine.
No, and it is something that we see all over the world, Andreas, to a certain extent, countries dealing with how they've treated populations within their own borders, how they've treated populations abroad.
We all have blind spots, right, that we don't necessarily talk about. I'm no expert on the British blind spots, but in Norway as well, we only recently started talking openly about the atrocities that were done against our indigenous population, the Sami. It's in Norwegian territory. It's not the same as the colony far away, or the history during wartime. What we emphasize during courses when we grow up in education, or what we learn, what BBC highlights or not, it's not accidental. Right, it's all deliberate, and we choose these the emphasis that we do. But I was also wondering a question to Kavita about the consequences of this specific family, because for me it was unheard of. Right, I haven't really learned anything about the Bengal famine. But then I'm wondering, can we see any lingering consequences today in terms of politics or in terms of population in that area? That of course looks very different today.
Mm. I think that. What I think is quite interesting is in India, actually, and this is the thing that surprised me, remembrance is quite complicated, because the people who died were people who were already just about surviving. And I think that's probably still the case for the kind of the survivors as well. But I think the memory of famine really impacted agricultural policy in India. And I think that it was so devastating for it that it then kind of impacted, and it still does today, how they deal with agrarian life. So what I found interesting in India is that the memory of the famine is not held by the people who died or by the people who survived. It's held by the people who observed it. And so that really affects how you tell the story of the famine. And actually, all these survivors live in the countryside. You know, there are still some today, and nobody had bothered to talk to them.
Yeah. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Such is the way of the World Service. The BBC News waits for nobody. But Kavita, thank you so much for coming and discussing that with us. That's Kavita Puri. And you can find 3 Million online on the BBC Sounds app, wherever you find your podcast. You can listen to that. More from Rosa and Andreas here in the studio. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC with me, Luke Jones.